we've talked about Jesus going before Annas, Jesus going before Caiaphas, Jesus going before the Sanhedrin, Jesus going before Pilate, Jesus going before Herod, and now we're back to Jesus once again appearing before Pilate. And as we mentioned just a few minutes ago, we need to look at all four accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, to try to keep the sequence orderly. So let's get our helpers lined up. John will be read from a little bit later, so if you volunteer for John, you're going to sort of be saved for the end. But who wants to take care of Matthew 27 for us? We'll have some verses that we want read from that chapter. Matthew 27? Jeff? And then we'll have some verses read from Mark chapter 15, our Mark 15 reader. Who wants to be that one? All right, Lois? And then Luke, we'll need some information read from Luke 23. Who wants to take care of Luke 23? All right, Steve. And then we'll also need a little bit later some information from John. That'll be John chapter 19. And who wants to be our John 19 reader? Betty. Okay. We came to the point last time where we talked about Barabbas. The crowd knows that Pilate is in the habit of releasing someone, and they end up asking for Barabbas over Jesus. I think I mentioned to you that Barabbas, there's some things that we know about him. There's some things that we don't know about him. Barabbas may have been his name. Barabbas may have been a nickname. We do know that he was a notable prisoner, Mark 15, verse 7. We also know that he was involved with those, bound with them that made insurrection, men who in insurrection had created murder. That's also in Mark chapter 15, verse 7. Luke 23, verse 19 tells us that Barabbas had been cast into prison. But I think what is really interesting here is a detail that is one that unless you're going through and trying to pull all this together and look carefully at the text, you might overlook. Let's see what we've got in Matthew chapter 27, verse 17.
Therefore, when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, Whom will ye that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus?
All right. Who brings up Barabbas? Now, the crowd knows that Pilate's in the custom of releasing somebody. But who initiates the discussion, do you want Jesus or Barabbas?
Pilate
does. Now, based on what I just described about Pilate, now remember he's a murderer, John 18, verse 40. He's involved with insurrection. You've got a murderer, you've got a robber, and an insurrectionist. It's the same strategy that people do today. Child doesn't want to eat something. So the parent says, well, okay, you know, you can either eat the spinach or you can eat the Brussels sprouts. Which do you want? Well, the child is not all that fond about Brussels sprouts, but he really hates spinach. So what does the dad do? Gives him a choice, you know, that is just so undesirable, the child is going to say, okay, I'm going to do this because I don't like the other choice. And I think that's what you see with Pilate. We often talk about how slick politicians try to be, how wily they are. And that's what I see in Matthew chapter 27, verse 17. He goes and picks out what was probably the worst of the worst among the prisoners, Barabbas. This guy, do you want a killer in your backyard? You want a robber in your backyard? He doesn't want to deal with Jesus. We've already pointed that out. So he goes and gets this fella and says, you've got two to choose from. Do you want the Brussels sprouts or do you want the other option? And he was surely hoping they're going to choose Jesus, even though they don't like him, over Barabbas. But amazingly, the crowd said, we want Barabbas. So that is absolutely stunning. All right, he's asked by the multitude. This is Mark chapter 15, verse 8, to release a prisoner. That's in Luke chapter 23, verse 13 and 14. And let's actually hear what we have in Luke 23, verses 13 and 14.
And they went and found as he had said unto them, and they made ready the Passover. And when the hour was come, he sat down and focused.
No, I think that's Luke 22, isn't it? Okay, let's head over one more chapter, Luke 23. We'll start with verse 13 and read through verse 14. That's okay, yeah.
When he had called together the chief priests and the rulers and people, said unto them, ye have brought this man unto me as one that perverted the people. And behold, I have examined him before you, and found no fault in this man touching those things whereof ye accused him.
Okay, a couple of interesting points here. Pilate said what? I have, that word begins with E, I have examined him. Now, if you were to look at that word in the original text, you'd find that a little bit later. It's also used in the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 17, verse 11. Now, these were more noble than those in Thessalonica in that they received the word with all readiness of mind. What were they doing? Examining the scriptures, how often? Daily, to see whether or not these things were so. So there were some people later who became Christians. They daily examined. They're paying close attention. When Pilate comes along and talks about Jesus, he says, I've examined him. So this wasn't anything that was really quick. Anybody gone in for a doc exam and you felt like the doc didn't spend enough time with you? You know, kind of like 2 minutes and out. Okay, you're good. No problem. You know, here's a prescription. That's not generally what people want when it comes to an exam. Check me out. I have a problem or this needs to be evaluated. The medicine is not working. And Pilate did an examination. And as we start looking at additional passages tonight, we'll see just how thorough that was. Then let's notice this. Let's go back and read that one more time, Steve, verses 14 and 15, Luke 23. And I want you to see a fine distinction here. There it is. Stop. Verse 14. I have found what?
No fault.
No fault. Now you could underline that. Now let's skip to verse 15.
Nor yet Herod, for I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death.
There it is. No fault. Verse 14. And now in verse 15 we have
nothing worthy of death.
That pretty much covers it, doesn't it? So when Pilate is talking about the Lord, he says, There's really nothing here. I've examined him, I've checked him out, and he is not guilty of any crime. So we have in Luke chapter 23, verse 16, a verse which we didn't read, that next verse. Let's see what Pilate tries to do.
Will therefore chastise him and release him.
Okay, I'm going to scourge him and release him. We noted a few weeks ago from our Acts class, Acts chapter 3, verse 13, that Pilate was a little later. Also mentioned as far as someone who wanted to release the Lord. Now somebody says, well, let me back that up a little bit. Was Pilate making a nice offer for Jesus? Scourge him and release him.
A nice offer for
yeah.
Jesus? No.
No. If you scourge somebody, what did you do? Or what didn't you do?
You didn't kill him, but almost.
Yeah. You know, you didn't let him off the hook. But you're right, you beat somebody half to death. And there were some people who actually died from that. If you didn't die from the beating, you might have been permanently crippled. So when he says, I'll scourge Jesus and let him go, that was not a nice offer. Had that happened, Jesus could have been crippled, he could have died, other people surely would have died from that. The Lord managed to get through that, but he wasn't making a very pleasant offer. And then too, it's interesting that as you look at how Pilate refers to Jesus, we'll look at Mark 15, verse 9 first. And then we'll also go back to Matthew and see what we've got in Matthew 27, verse 17. You see that a lot of stuff seems to be going through Pilate's head, not only in what he does and what he says, what he asks, but also in how he describes the Lord. Let's see Mark 15, verse 9. All right, there it is. So he addresses Jesus or describes Jesus as King of the Jews there, Mark 15, verse 9. And then let's see what we've got in Matthew's account, 27, verse 17.
Therefore, when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, whom will ye that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ?
Now, isn't that interesting? Pilate, as I said a couple of weeks ago, Pilate likely knew a little bit more than maybe some give him credit for. Jesus is called the Christ, the Messiah, King of the Jews. That doesn't sound like somebody who is completely ignorant of Jesus. And then, as we continue to move forward in the text, we find some other things, not only about Pilate, but we find some things about Pilate's wife. Let's go back to Matthew 27, verse 19, and just read the first few verses.
When he was set down on the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying, Have thou nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many...
Okay, that's enough. We'll come back to that in just a second. Pilate is sitting where? On the judgment seat. Now, we're also going to find Pilate making a judgment in John chapter 19. That's going to be John chapter 19, verse 13. We'll not deal with that tonight. But that's going to be a separate incident. So don't look at what we have in Matthew 27, verse 19, and John 19, 13, describing the same place. This judgment seat, it was, and you have a similar thing today. Maybe it's for authority, maybe to give some importance to the proceedings. But you ever walk in a courtroom? Anybody ever been in a courtroom? Okay. What do you see as far as the judge?
He's a liar.
All right, he's going to be, every time I've seen a judge, he's higher. Now, it's not like he's 100 feet up there, but I mean, there is an elevated platform. That's not just true for our judicial system. That's also been true for other people throughout time. And as Pilate is described here, he is sitting on the judgment seat, The word that's used, bima, would have described or denoted an elevated platform. So you have here, he's made this offer, he's to scourge Jesus and release him, and now his wife sends a message. Does the wife come personally or not?
No.
No. Who brought the message? I don't know. But Pilate has used someone as a messenger. And let's go back and read that full verse now.
When he was set down on the judge's seat, his wife said unto him, saying, have thou nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him.
Okay, let's break that down a little bit. First of all, have nothing to do with him. Well, it's a little late at this point, isn't it? I mean, Pilate's already in pretty deep. I mean, this is the second round with Jesus. So when you have those words, have nothing to do with him, how might you understand that? That probably doesn't mean don't have nothing to do with him, but don't do what?
Don't do anything more.
Yeah, don't condemn him. You know, this is where you need to kind of draw the line. And then some other things. Pilate's wife refers to Jesus in what kind of way? She describes him as an...
a just man.
Well, as an innocent or as a just man. I think that's interesting. Pilate not only had some information about the Lord, but his wife had some information about the Lord. And then, as you look at this information, she describes Jesus as someone who caused her to suffer how many things?
Many
things this day. And as we talked about before, these events are happening early in the morning, so you can see that she, you know, we don't know how long she may have been up, but she does get word to him, and she says that was based on a dream. Her message was based on a dream, and she says it was because of him that is the Lord. Now, there's some things I'd like to know, but the Bible doesn't tell me. Was this woman, who is unnamed in Scripture, someone who had dreams, someone who had premonitions? You find sometimes some people who are very intuitive. They'll know that the phone's going to ring or they're going to dream a dream, and that says that someone is going to, you know, be announcing a baby or someone's going to die or various things like that. Don't know exactly how that worked. Maybe she didn't generally have premonitions or dreams, and this was a special set of circumstances from God. You could go either way, or maybe there's a mixture there, but she did come to the conclusion that she'd suffered many things because of Jesus, and she needed to communicate this message to her husband. And that, of course, also would have added to Pilate's reluctance as far as having Jesus put to death. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down a little further, Ray?
She didn't really suffer any physical things that I can tell from that.
No.
Just in the dream. So, and that's enough to scare you. And certainly she would have known why she was having those dreams. So she would probably been very justified in wanting him to not do any harm to Jesus.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that you mention it in that way. I don't know that we would use the word nightmare, but maybe to kind of put it in a perspective that we can appreciate, we might use the word nightmare. But generally from a nightmare, you wake up and you know you feel like you've been shot or you were run over or whatever the nightmare, my nightmare was, and you get up and you think, okay, check, I've got all my arms and my legs and I'm not shot. And, or somebody reassures you that you know you're not out in the cold and freezing to death, whatever it might be. And everything's okay. It might take you a couple minutes to kind of shake that off. But she didn't do that. And she knows that it's because of the Lord. So what exactly was that? It sounds like it was maybe in a slightly different category than that kind of dream slash premonition, but she felt confident enough in what she'd experienced to send this message to her husband, and he took some stock in it. We'll follow up on that in a second, but we'll see if there's anybody else that wants to make a contribution. Anybody? All right. When people talk about dreams and premonitions, you sort of have a wide range. There are some people who say, oh, that there's nothing to that. It's all a bunch of hooey. Nobody can, you know, have that kind of sensation. There are some other people who sort of live by that stuff. They feel like they're guided by that. And then you have some people who are sort of in the middle. There's some people who say, well, okay, you know, sometimes that happens, and sometimes that's a pretty good gauge, and we do want to be mindful of that. If you go back and you look at the Romans seem to have been big into things like premonitions, dreams. And if that is a part of your culture and that's something that you pay a lot of attention to, then can you imagine what Pilate must have been thinking? This is not just a dream, but I mean, this is a dream in front of this very messy trial, and that's one more bad omen if you're looking at it from a pagan standpoint. If you go back and you look at Pilate, just like today, you have rulers, and it doesn't quite work like this in the United States. Our system is set up a little differently. But if you are the king of a country, when it comes to currency, what can you do? Could you have your image put on the coin if you wanted? have your son or daughter's image, your wife's image put in a coin? Sure. I mean, it's your country's money. You're the one who's in charge. Well, Pilate was able to have some coins made under his administration. And at least two of those coins have some imagery which we would associate with divination. There was on one of the coins an augur staff. An augur would have been someone who looked for the signs. You go out there. Maybe the best illustration for it would be the Indians. You think about the Indians. They had their sign. They're going to go out and send out the young brave, and he's going to be sleeping out there for maybe a couple nights or maybe a week, and he's going to get a sign. There's the eagle that comes, or there's the hawk that comes, or there's the buzzard that comes. And depending on what they see out there in nature, then it's either sort of thumbs up or thumbs down. And the Romans were really big into that. I would also, and I think this is important to mention, I do not believe, and I don't believe the Bible could ever be used to teach that when you have someone who has a premonition, has a dream, an inkling, a gut feeling, whatever that might be, there's no basis for concluding that's part of the occult or that's part of Satanism or it is somehow evil. Fortune-telling would certainly fall into the evil category, as would the occult. But sometimes people do have a pretty good sense. It's like an animal. Ever seen an animal that has what is sometimes referred to as a sixth sense? They can tell that danger's coming. You find that. There was a picture from Gatlinburg. Some of you know. They probably didn't need a sixth sense for that. But as the fires were burning, there were a couple of deer that were standing in a pool of water. Anybody see that picture? Now, maybe they felt the hair being singed on the back and figured we need to go somewhere. But animals get that sense that there is danger and they need to find a safe place to go. Dogs will come up and, you know, sniff people, and sometimes they're good at determining whether a person has a good character or bad character. People and animals sometimes just seem to have an innate sense for that kind of thing. But you do find that Pilate gets this additional information, and he was getting very, very worried. Anything that you want to cover before we look at some more material? All right. Had there been no interference from others, it might be that Pilate could have scourged Jesus and persuaded that the people that, okay, this is really the way that things need to go, and we'll just sort of shut this down. Pilate, we know, certainly wanted to free the Lord. But as you look at Matthew chapter 27, verse 20, we have an additional detail that helps us understand why things went as they did. I mean, certainly it was heaven's plan, but let's see who helped things out. Matthew 27, 20.
But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas to destroy Jesus.
Okay. Today we have kind of a different word for it, and it's different, I guess, in some respects, but it's still the same in some others. What's the name for the person who comes into the community and riles people up? We're going to protest. We're going to go out and burn things down. Who are those people sometimes?
Agitators.
Well, okay, that would be one description for them. All right, activists, community organizers, there are some people, they're going to go out there and lead the charge, so forth. That's what you have when it comes to Jesus. You have the chief priests and you have the scribes. They're out there stirring up the people. And that happens. You might find it on a college campus, you know, Ray, California. I'm sure that you had it out there. You get into a large city, Chicago, and they have the big protests that you can see on TV and so forth. And there are these people, the chief priests, the elders and so forth, they're stirring up the crowds. They're persuading the crowds to ask for Barabbas and destroy the Lord. In fact, let's see what word is used in Mark chapter 15, verse 11.
But the chief priests stirred up the multitude to ask him to release Barabbas for them instead.
Okay. I'm not sure that all translations use the word stirred. That one does. The ASV does. And you can imagine, just like you're stirring a pot. Everything is being mixed up, and you have a lot of people who are very, very angry. That preceding verse, Mark 15, verse 10, says the chief priests were envious of the Lord. This pressure is continuing to mount. The people are asking for someone to be released. I've talked about the fact that Barabbas has been put forth. Jesus, of course, has been identified as King of the Jews, or the other option is going to be Barabbas, and the people say, who do you want? Matthew 27, verse 22.
27, 2? 2-2. 2-2. Pilate saith unto them, what shall I do then with Jesus, which is called Christ? They all say unto him, let him be crucified.
Two quick points. Once again, Pilate's trying to extricate himself from this set of circumstances. And he asks, what should I do? Well, he knew what they wanted. But he asks again. The crowd says, it's not just get rid of him, but now the point is, do what?
Crucify him.
Crucify him. Not just kill him, but this specific method, very cruel way to die. And in addition to that detail, how many of the people were calling out for his death? All. Now that doesn't necessarily mean, as we've talked about in some other classes, that every single one, you might have had a couple people that didn't say, crucify him, crucify him. But that certainly was the response from the people. That's what the thinking was. And as we talked about from Mark 15, they were being stirred up to do that. Now here's something that may or may not be new for you. We may be somewhat familiar with all these people and what they did. But let's talk about Barabbas for just a second. Every once in a while in Scripture, we'll see Bar, B-A-R, before a name or in conjunction with a name. Anybody remember what Bar means? Very good. All right. Bar, we could have put this in a board. Bar, and then what else do you have in that name Barabbas? B-A-R.
Rabbi.
Well, you're close. B-A-R. What are the next few words? A, B, Abba.
Father.
Yeah. Now put that together. Bar, son of father. Barabbas. Now there are some. I don't want to make too much of this, but there are some who have thought, and this kind of goes down what the road that Brian was mentioning a moment ago, that it could mean son of rabbi, and I guess that's possible as well. But I think it's very, very interesting to at least note that the son, small s, the son of the father, Barabbas, was released, while the son, big S, of the father was crucified. And I can't help but think that there was a reason why Barabbas was chosen. A lot of reasons, but maybe this was one of them. Son of the father, perhaps applied to both. Anybody want to comment on that or anything else before we say a little bit more? Right?
Is that any idea then who his father would have been?
No.
Are we thinking of the devil, Satan?
Well, I think if you want to trace it back, spiritually speaking, that absolutely would be true. When we think about an earthly father, whoever that may have been.
What might Pilate been thinking, is this an evil one? He's a son of some evil one?
Yeah. But he certainly was sort of the cream of the crop when it came to evil. I mean, if you're involved with robbery, insurrection, and murder, I mean, you're sort of at the dregs of society. But yeah. Gary?
Is it possible that the devil could have caused Pilate's wife to have the dream? And my thought is, if obviously for Scripture to be fulfilled, Christ had to be crucified. And obviously the devil doesn't want Scripture to be fulfilled. So is he trying to use Pilate's wife to convince him to not crucify him so the plan won't go as according to Scripture?
Okay. The Bible's a big book. But offhand, I cannot think of anything anywhere in Scripture which indicates that the devil is or has the capability to influence a person's mind to the point where they're going to dream something. You do find that, I mean, for example, you think about Acts 5. Peter asked Ananias and Sapphira, why did Satan fill your heart? Not that I think that was a miraculous or supernatural act, but the devil gave them an opportunity to take advantage of that. You also have in relation to Peter and Jesus, Jesus said, get behind me, Satan. When Peter was being used by the devil, you have, for example, Judas, the devil entered into the heart of that traitor. But none of that would, at least as I understand it, enter into the miraculous category. So it's an interesting thought, but I can't think of any passage in the Bible which would suggest that Satan was able to somehow influence people with dreams. I don't even know that I could point to an angel, a good angel, that did that. God seems to have kept that power for himself.
Okay. I think about the woman that had the demon that was advertising, I think it was it Paul when he was out on his mission, and he had to take the demon out of her because it wasn't time for him to have attention drawn.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know if since a demon can be put in a person.
Well, she was, I think that's Acts 19. She was telling fortunes. And certainly had some abilities there. And you find a similar thing with demonic strength. People sometimes bound the demon-possessed with chains, and I mean the strongest chains they had, and the people still bound them. I don't know that I would be able to prove this with 100% certainty, but if people don't get enough sleep, they generally go crazy. And when you look at the fellows who were in the tombs, it doesn't look like they got enough sleep. Now, somebody could say, well, that's why they were crazy. Well, I'm not quite sure that was true. But demons seem to have fueled the body in some ways that would be beyond normal capacity. But even with all those items, still, the ability to influence dreams in that way, maybe it was possible. But I just can't, at least right now, call to mind anything which would allow me to point back to that and say, here would be a basis that I could use to support that. And like I say, that might be something that I'm just missing or overlooking right now. But that's an interesting thought. Anybody else? All right, let's go back and see where we left off. Pilate was very hesitant about putting the Lord to death. So let's see what we've got in Luke chapter 23, verse 22.
And he said unto them the third time.
Let's stop right there. He said unto them when? The
third time.
Now this guy is the ruler. He's the governor. And yet he's there out trying to work things out with the crowd, and now he comes to a third time. Let's read it again. This time we'll take the whole verse.
And he said to them, unto them the third time, what evil hath he done? I have found no cause of death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go.
Okay, third time. Pilate is still working on this. At least he is persistent and trying to offer some kind of compromise. He asks the crowd, what evil has he done? Well, they can't answer that question. There is no evil that he's done. They've made up all the charges that we've talked about in the past. And then Pilate comes along once again and says, I found no cause of death in him. We talked about from verses 14 and 15 how he's already made that same kind of point. So once again, he makes the offer, what will I do for you? I will chastise him. I'll beat him half to death, and then he'll be released. But that compromise was not going to work. And as you look at what is said, the reaction of the people is now even stronger than it was. Let's take a look at Mark chapter 15, verse 14.
But Pilate was saying to them, why, what evil has he done? But they all shouted more, crucify him.
Yeah, so here you are, you're trying to shut things down. Now the people are shouting out even more. It was already bad. But now it's just been ratcheted up and ratcheted up and ratcheted up. And these people are not going to relent. They simply will not quit. So that's why. And now this is at the point where if you remember back to what we have in Matthew 27, verses 24 and 25. This is where these verses now fit in. And let's read them. Matthew 27, verses 24 and 25.
When Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See ye to it. Then answered all the people and said, his blood be on us and on our children.
Okay, that is no exaggeration. Remember what we just talked about as far as the third time? All the other offers that Pilate has made, he has literally gone through everything that he can possibly do. Now, having said that, I'm going to put an asterisk on that. Because a little later, remember I told you over in John chapter 19, verse 13? Let's just take a quick peek at that because, you know, we're going to be a couple weeks out of class. John chapter 19, verse 13. All right. Now this spot, I'll just give you this little tidbit right now. This spot allowed Pilate to put himself into a position where he could reverse his judgment. And we're going to see in just a couple of minutes that Pilate passes sentence. And you would think at that point everything has sort of been taken care of and finalized. And yes, pretty much that's true. But he is so uninterested in having Jesus put to death that as you move forward a little bit in John chapter 19, he is at this place and it's one more opportunity to try to reverse course. And once again, the people don't let him. But I mean, this fella, he's trying to backpedal. He is trying to do everything he possibly can to not have Jesus put to death. Now, did he have the authority to say Jesus is going to live?
Yes.
But he is being squeezed on every side. So, on the one hand, it's very difficult to have much compassion for Pilate because he was spineless. But on the other hand, you also, I think, have to realize, understand, and maybe even to some degree appreciate the force that was being exerted on him. And there was a lot of pressure. Today, it's the same kind of thing. When people don't get their way with a particular politician or they don't get their way when it comes to a vote that they want, what do? They put pressure, don't they? We're not going to buy your products. We're not going to come to your store. We're going to protest. This is old style stuff. And it's exactly what we see when it comes to Jesus. We'll never know why the crowd was so insistent on having Jesus put to death and Barabbas being released, but I do think that there are a couple of possibilities. Do you want to suggest at least one? I mean, we know that Barabbas was bad. He's the bottom of the barrel. He's the murderer. He's the robber. He's the insurrectionist. He's the guy that you don't want anywhere near your neighborhood. But why call for his release and say, this Jesus guy, you know, heal some of our friends maybe. We want him to go to the cross and be crucified. What would account for that?
You talked about the instigators.
All right, that's one reason. They're stirring things up and people are not thinking too well. What might have been another reason? What did the Jews want? What was the yoke around their neck? If you were a Jew, you saw it probably every day.
Get put out of the temple?
Well, even worse than that.
The law?
Hmm?
The law?
Well, no. Even worse than that. Who had control over you?
The Romans.
The Romans. And what did you want? You want to be free, right? You don't want the Romans there. Remember back there in the Sermon on the Mount? Jesus said, whoever compels you to go a mile, go two. Who was going to compel you to go the mile? The Romans were. They controlled your life. Now, you weren't a slave like they'd been in Egypt, but you're still under foreign control. And for you to get up every day and realize that the Romans are over you, very distasteful for the Jew, especially if you figure that you're God's people. Now, let's go back and think about Barabbas for a second. A robber, a murderer, and an insurrectionist. If you're going to have somebody released and you're chafing at Rome, who's a natural guy to say, you be our leader? It's Barabbas. I don't know that that was in the minds of the Jews, but he certainly would have been a very logical choice. Now, when you think about Jesus being a king and an earthly deliverer, people had already kind of tried that. John, I believe it was John chapter 6, said they tried to take him and force him to become a king. The Lord didn't want any part of that. He said, remember, John 18:36, my kingdom is not of this world. I'm not going to help you out. Well, if you're not going to help us out, Jesus, then there's someone who will. So I think maybe they were more focused on that than maybe considering the fact that Barabbas had been a robber and a murderer. Sometimes people just want bad folks to accomplish something. But Satan had certainly convinced these people to accept the only one who couldn't help them, and then the opposite was true as well, to reject the one who could help them. We talked about the tumult, and Mark, let's have 15:15 read as well, Mark 15:15. Okay, there it is. Matthew's account says there was this tumult. It looked like that there was going to be this great uprising. And then Mark tells us 15:15 that he wanted to content the multitude. Get out of control, so we've got to bring down the heat. We've got to lower the pressure, and that's what he did. And then Luke's account of this is Luke chapter 23, verses 24 and 25. All right, thank you. Luke ties it all together. A lot of angry people. He needs to content them. Mark, Luke says he gave sentence, past sentence, and said, you're going to get your way. Well, that's kind of a bad way to go, but sometimes that is what happens. The crowd said, what's true? He needs to die, and we are willing to have his blood, not only on our own lives, but on whose lives as well? All right, that's kind of serious. But people today will still do the same thing. My family will be responsible, we'll take over the debt, and even if it needs to involve the kids, the grandkids, that's perfectly fine. Well, they made that statement, let his blood be on us and our children. Did God let them accept that? Yeah. And they got whacked. When and how? All right, about 70 AD, roughly 40 years later from this time, the Romans come to town. The Romans, remember, they didn't like, and they ravaged Jerusalem. And it was bad. It's probably a gross estimate, but grossly high, but there are sources which indicate that more than a million people perished in the siege against Jerusalem. Disease, you have people being crucified. It's said that the streets, blood just flowed down like water, so it was very, very bad. It's a little ironic that these people said, let his blood be on us, we'll accept the guilt. They really needed the blood, didn't they? The benefits of the blood? But they didn't understand that, so they were trying to reject what was actually required for them to be in a right relationship with God. All right, now let's head over to the book of John. We'll stop for a second and see if there's anything you want to address, because we're doing that. Brian?
I think it's interesting, too, their comment about blood be on us and our children, comparing it to Acts 2:39. This promise will be
yes.
to you and to your children.
Yeah. That's what the people were thinking. This is what God was thinking, and they were really at odds with one another as far as the two points. Yes, so you do have great irony there. All right, John chapter 19, verse 1. Let's start there.
Then Pilate therefore took Jesus and replied to
him. Okay. What does the text say? Pilate took Jesus and flogged him or scourged him. Now, who did the scourging? Well, you think so? The text says Pilate scourged him.
Had him scourged?
I think that's the idea. If you're the governor and so forth, you know, you're not going to go and get your, you know, judicial robes dirty. You're going to hand it over to somebody. Here's a passage which is helpful because sometimes a person will say, well, look, the Bible says so-and-so did it here, but in another passage it says so-and-so did it over here, and there's a contradiction. No. You sometimes find that kind of activity where authorizing an activity means, for example, somebody says, we need to have some paper ordered in the workplace. And you say, I'll take care of it. Well, now, if you listen to those words, how could that be understood? I'll take care of it. I'll do it. I might personally do it. Or what else might that mean? I'm going to delegate Jeff, and he's going to take care of it. Now, I've still done it, but I didn't do it personally. So this is, not to belabor the point, but when you see that kind of wording, be careful. Stop and ask the question, might this have been delegated to somebody else, or was this personally done by the individual? So can't say for 100% certainty, but I do think that that probably was not done by Pilate. All right, and then let's pick up with verses 2, 3, and 5. Couple of quick points here. Why do you think they put the robe on Jesus? Wanted to be kind to him? All right, humiliation, mockery. It was one more way to go ahead and, you know, make things as bad as it possibly could be for him. The words that are used in verse 3 as far as the mocking, what the soldiers did to the Lord, you have the present tense being used there. So this wasn't one strike, it wasn't one hit, and then they're done. But this was repeated activity. I remember the Lord had already been over to Herod, and Herod and the soldiers had mocked the Lord. They'd put some kind of clothing on him and mistreated him as well. And now you have the people here associated with Pilate doing the same kind of thing. They're engaging in the same kind of activity. Now, if you're a Roman, we talked about what it must have felt like to have been a Jew. But if you were a Roman, what would have been your mindset as you go through life? You know, if you're a Jew, you're religious, right? But if you're a Roman, what's your mindset?
Trust yourself as a Roman.
All right. I think that's going to be one thing. That you know, you're going to trust in yourself. We're a Roman. Look at the roads that we've made and look at the military that we have and so forth. If you're a Roman soldier, how do you feel? Let's... Yes, that was a word I thought you said. You have this guy from a third world country. You know, he comes, he's got his canteen and he's got his musket from 1916. All right. And then he stands up against a Navy SEAL. You think the guy from the third world country feels a little inferior? I mean, the Navy SEAL's decked out with the finest equipment that money can buy, and this other guy, you're thinking, man, you know, why don't you just go back home? You're not going to be that productive. If you're a Roman soldier, and somebody comes along and says, I'm king of the Jews, what would have been your reaction, do you think? Are you kidding me? I mean, who are the people who are powerful? Who are the people who have it on? It's the Romans. It's us, you idiot. So along with the mockery, I think you have to bear that in mind as far as what the Roman attitude would have been. And that really helps us understand what Jesus was facing. All right, then we have Jesus. He's being clothed in a garment, and not just any garment, but it's a garment with a specific color. What was the color? Purple. Not to get political. But if you didn't see this, you can pull it up on a lot of different sites on the web. But when Hillary Clinton made her concession speech, anybody see the clothing she wore? She had on purple. And if you saw Bill Clinton in that same clip, and again, there are a lot of pictures of this on the web, what color was his tie? It was purple. Now, I don't think that was an accident. Now, if it had just been one who was wearing purple, maybe you could say that was just the color of the day. But when they both show up for a concession speech and it's purple, something's going on. Now, people have speculated why that they both wore purple, and you know, we could spend a lot of time on that and still not know without asking her. But what went through my mind, correctly or incorrectly, was it was a way of saying, we're still somebody. You know, we still matter. I'm the queen, so to speak. Now, that may not have been going through her head. That was what went through my head. But when you look at the colors in the Bible, it's an interesting thing. Hebrews, I don't know that they were nearly as maybe obsessed with colors as we are, because we've changed things with colors a little bit, haven't we? You go in and you tell Lowe's you want some white paint. What do they tell you? Yeah, or which shade? You know, we've got 76 to choose from, and it's kind of like, oh, wow. And then, you know, you start going down the list, and you think, well, how about yellow? And it's just endless. So we have various hues, and even with fabric, somebody says, well, this is red. I mean, if you look around tonight, you know, red, 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 3, some red on Ray, 4, some red on Steve, 5, some red on Stan, 6, or maybe it's maroon. But anyway, it's close enough to red. You get those various shades. But back in ancient times, it wasn't like that. You didn't have all the different variations in color. But purple was a big deal. We remember, I think, from Acts chapter 16, verse 14, that Lydia wore, or she was a seller of purple. Back in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 5, you've got purple being used in the royal courts. And John, as he talks about in Revelation chapter 17, 4, and Revelation 18, verse 16, the woman, she is decked out. This evil, this godless woman is decked out in purple. Another color as well, scarlet to represent sin, but the purple, that she was acting like a queen. All right, we've got to shut it down there for tonight, and plan is to pick up with this in 2 weeks. Thank you.